but not yet set. Like a runner at the starting blocks, it has taken position for the race to come. Now is the moment to focus the mind, to tense every muscle for the leap to action when the starter pistol fires. It's time to feed forward, to align every element for the great performance. The Visioneers have just 4 months to prepare the planet for the transformation to the global mind. Hope runs high across the world. Positive energy pours out of every project in every place where a band of Visioneers has gathered to make a difference. But around it all, there yet remains a web of negativity spun by minds not willing to let go, still intent to hold fast to gains of personal advantage, no matter what the cost to others and the earth. Into this engagement, the spirit of the Visioneers now pours full strength. Wow. Des, that's a stirring introduction to the next chapter, which you've called Feed Forward. I guess we're feeding forward to the Congress of the Global Mind. Is that right?
Yes. But before that happens, two of the characters who figured prominently earlier on return. The first is Kamal Rashid, who you will remember was badly injured by a stab wound in the chest when he intervened in the assassination attempt against Mark and Esther at their wedding in Jerusalem.
Oh, yes, I remember only too well. The last time we saw Kamal was when Mark and Esther visited him in the hospital before they left on their honeymoon. He was still unconscious.
Yes, well, now we see him recovering and watching the launching of the trisets. He has a sudden breakthrough in consciousness as he remembers what Muhammad had said that morning in Bethlehem when he had come with Mark and David Roth to free Esther and her friend Jenny Lovix. Referring to Mark, Muhammad had said, "Standing right here among you is a man unarmed and unafraid, leading a group of ordinary people who are working tirelessly to bring the world to its senses before it becomes such an abomination that no one can live on it, Arab, Jew, or anyone else." Yes, Kamal realizes now it's happening, and the way for him and his people must be to join that flow. He reaches for a buzzer beside his bed and presses it. A nurse responds to his call. "I want to speak to Colonel Greenberg," he says. "Will you please bring me a telephone?"
Yes. And now we get these scenes in Kamal's hospital room with Mark, Mohammed, Colonel Greenberg, and Esther coming in a bit late. It's a pivotal moment. Kamal addresses the group.
"You have a big dream," Mark ventures. "Maybe I'm ready now to come at least partway with you. I'm glad, too, that my brother Muhammad is here. Please sit with me. And you, too, Colonel Greenberg." When the three men are seated around the bed, Kamal continues. "Do you remember, Muhammad, when you came with Mark Venture and David Roth to Bethlehem, where we were holding Esther and her friend hostage?" Kamal pauses and looks at Greenberg. "I know up until now, Colonel, I've never admitted involvement in that incident. And Mark was true to his word and never disclosed it. But none of that matters anymore. In the last weeks, I've been to death's door at the hands of one of my own countrymen who chose to take sides with Carlos Palmyra against my judgment. Now I lie here, a prisoner in an Israeli hospital. Who Kamal Rashid was before no longer seems important to me. I've had time to think. Then yesterday I saw your vision broadcast to the world, and I remembered the vision that both of you, Mark and Muhammad, spoke of that morning in Bethlehem. I couldn't see it then, but I remember the words. Arab and Jewish neighbors existing side by side as prosperous trading partners in a world growing rich with the products of cooperation. It seemed impossible then, but now somehow I think it can be done."
Kamal, still weak from his injuries and struggling with the emotion of his words, falls silent. Mark speaks softly.
"Kamal, good friend, you've learned that to speak about impossible things, you must first move your position to higher ground. From there, they no longer seem impossible. That's what the visioneers are doing, moving people to higher ground in their minds. It's a great day for the world to hear Kamal Rashid say, "He's moving."
Before Kamal can reply, Esther enters the room, dressed as a visioneer, breathless from hurrying. She touches the young Arab's hands and joins the others around the bed. Kamal now looks at all of them.
"I have a thought. Not very clear as yet. But I would like to form a team of visioneers made up of Palestinians and Israelis. We could call it Palace. Its purpose would be to bring our people together, to work on cooperative projects. I think it might be possible."
With an excited shout, Mohammed exclaims a little louder than usual hospital decorum permits.
"What did I tell you? I've been saying it for months, ever since your speech to the United Nations, Mark. There's movement to end the conflict and bloodshed. Mark and Esther, you gave us the symbol for it in your New Jerusalem. And now, Kamal, you can be its spirit as a visioneer. God is great. God is good. Now we have a place for hope to grow."
Esther speaks to Kamal softly. "When you were lying here, deep in coma, I begged you to fight for your life to return as leader to your people. Thank you for doing that. And I thank God from all of us for being with you." She looks around, smiling at all of them, and adds, "Our common God is indeed very great and very good."
Mark looks across the bed at Colonel Greenberg. "Well, Colonel, as the authority figure here, what do you say about this young prisoner?"
"I think," replies Greenberg, "I need to talk to my minister."
And within the hour, Greenberg is in Chaim Shamir's office.
"Are you going to tell us what happens?"
"Not yet. Because now the other character I mentioned before returns. It's Elvira Ramos."
"Ugh. I don't like her. El Condor's girlfriend. Last time we heard of her, she was hiding out in Colombia."
"Yes, well, now she returns and tries to set up a strike against Esther while Esther is speaking in Los Angeles. However, along the way, Elvira has an incredible experience at Crestone in Colorado, where she had gone to see Esther speaking at the Crestone Pyramid. It seems that she had no control over herself. Something led her there. Let's read the account of what happens from the book."
"She is on a paved road which leads directly to the pyramid. But as she comes within a kilometer of the towering structure, Elvira turns off a side road. She's not yet ready to face the pyramid. The road winds up onto higher ground tucked under the Sangre de Cristo mountain range, which at this point rises precipitously straight up for several hundred meters above the valley floor. With the pyramid dropping away behind her, Elvira passes scattered mountain chalets tucked in among stunted pinyon pine and aspen trees in new leaf. The whole valley spreads out below as a sea of mottled green. What's in this place? Why is that pyramid here? The questions crowd into Elvira's mind. She passes a number of other buildings, not North American design, but Eastern, rather like temples or monasteries. She catches glimpses of figures in colored robes walking among the trees. She remembers having read somewhere that this was a popular place for various spiritual communities. Why are they here in the mountains of Colorado? Suddenly, she feels decidedly uncomfortable. This is no place for Elvira Ramos. The car comes to a dead end at the base of a towering mountain. The only way out is by means of a tight turnaround among large rocks and thick brush. The feeling of unease grips Elvira more tightly. She spins the car around, stops, backs it up, tries again, too fast. In a shower of flying gravel, the car lurches sideways and slides into a ditch. Engine racing, one rear wheel helplessly spinning, it settles down in the soft earth. Stuck. Elvira gets out, angry to the point of tears. She has no mechanical mind, absolutely no idea of what to do. She looks around, nothing. No one. only rocks and trees, and a beautiful, shining black car that has no possibility of going anywhere. Elvira's reserve brakes. She kicks the front wheel with her dainty pointed sandal, buries her head in her arms on the hood of the car, and begins to sob convulsively.
Pain and solutions both begin and end in the mind. That is truth.
The voice is just loud enough for Elvira to hear above her sobbing. She looks up, tries to stifle her tears. She sees no one, then turns, and there standing close by is a tall male figure wearing a long saffron-colored robe that falls simply from his shoulders to his feet. His brown, luminous eyes survey her closely, while a faint, enigmatic smile plays around the lips in the light brown face. Oh, I need help. My car is stuck.
Yes, I see that.
Sensing a solution at hand, Elvira quickly regains control of herself. If a few of you from the temple, or whatever you call it, get together, you can push it out.
The man doesn't reply. He just stands there, continuing to survey her in the same measured way. Irritable now, Elvira becomes demanding.
Well, are you going to help? I have a very tight schedule to keep.
Yes, I know about your schedule. It's one that you would best reconsider.
What do you mean? Elvira is hostile now, but still uncomfortable. Who are you to say that to me? All you need to do is gather up some of your friends to help. I don't appreciate comments about what I do.
When what you do disregards the sanctity of human life, you can expect to pay the consequences dearly.
He still hasn't moved. His eyes unwavering stare into hers. Elvira feels fingers of fear grabbing at her. She still tries to force her way out. How dare you speak to me like that? Who do you think you are?
My name is Baba Satchinanda. You will do well to remember that you met me on the road above the Crestone Pyramid when Esther Fisher was visiting. She is my special charge. She is protected. The aura around her is her shield.
Elvira gasps and steps away. She bumps into the car and feels her way nervously towards the door. Remembering that there's no escape here, she stops. Her voice has lost its edge. Fear closes around her throat. Baba Satya. Yes, she continues, barely above a whisper. I've heard of you at the wedding. They say you intervened. But here, in these robes, I thought you belonged to a temple.
My community is wherever people do good. For the other, there is strong justice. You will do well to remember that, Elvira Ramos. Remember, too, the aura that protects Esther Fisher. You can go now. If you drive your car gently, it will take you down to the pyramid.
He nods his head towards the door of the car. Trembling, her chest tight with pain, Elvira mechanically feels her way to get behind the steering wheel and start the engine. Effortlessly, the car glides forward. When she turns her head to look back to where Baba had been standing, there's nothing but the empty road. With no sense of time or conscious awareness, Elvira automatically guides the car along the mountain roads down to the soaring pyramid. Growing taller as she approaches, it fills her mind far beyond its actual size with the overpowering presence of shining white energy held to the earth by the strong black bands of the frame. A large crowd is gathered around the entrance just beyond the parking lot. Still barely conscious of what she's doing, Elvira parks her car. As she walks up to the rear of the crowd, she sees a raised speakers platform. A buzz of excitement goes through the crowd. Applause breaks out. Onto the platform steps Esther Fisher, wearing the blue and white uniform of the Visioneers, with her shining auburn hair hanging loose on her shoulders. She raises her arms in acknowledgement of the applause and prepares to speak. Elvira hears no words. Her attention is entirely consumed by the golden aura she sees shining around Esther's figure. Does Does anyone else see it? Elvira has no idea. Baba's words burn in her mind.
She is my special charge. She is protected. The aura around her is her shield.
Transfixed, Elvira stares at the phenomenon for several minutes. Esther is speaking, but the words have no meaning for Elvira. She turns away and hurries back to her car.
When Esther arrives at her hotel that evening in Los Angeles, a message is waiting for her. It is handwritten on hotel stationery, sealed in a hotel envelope.
It says, "Miss Fisher, it's imperative that I speak with you this evening. Please contact me in room 1202, no matter when you arrive. It is urgent and personal. Elvira Ramos."
The name immediately leaps into Esther's memory. The tall, elegant woman in a green sheath evening dress at Woodlands Restaurant in New York. Associate, confidant, mistress of Carlos Palmyra. Esther's immediate impulse is to seek assistance. Bill Bates and other members of her traveling party are at hand. But something tells her she should do this alone. It's after midnight when she calls room 1202. A woman's voice answers immediately.
"Yes? This is Esther Fisher. I received a message to call." "Yes. Thank you. I'm Elvira Ramos. You may remember me." "Yes, I do. May we speak?" "Now, it's very late." "Yes, I know. I'm sorry, but it's important. I have only this evening." "Very well, I'll meet you in the hotel lobby in 10 minutes.
When Esther arrives in the lobby, Elvira is already there. Esther recognizes the other woman immediately. The same classical beauty exudes, but something nervous and distraught detracts. Her expensive clothing is carelessly worn. Her makeup slightly smeared. She stands and extends her hand. She doesn't reply to Esther's greeting, but stares hard at her, uncomfortably long. Finally, Esther asks,
"Is anything wrong? It's still there." Elvira's voice is distracted. "I'm sorry," replies Esther, "I don't understand." "Did you know you are protected by an aura?"
Esther is embarrassed. Uncomfortable. Something is definitely not right with this woman. She's about to reply when Elvira raises her hand.
"No, please. Let me tell you what I want to say and then I'll leave. I came to Los Angeles, because it doesn't matter why I came. That's changed now. It's all canceled. You see, I went to Crestone to hear you speak. But instead, I met your protector, Baba Satsat. I don't know. It's an Indian name. He said that you're protected. He's put an aura around you. I can see it now."
It's Esther's turn to stare.
"What are you saying? You met Baba Satyananda up at Crestone, but he's not there. At least I didn't know he was." "It's no matter. I expect he's always around you. I didn't imagine it. He was definitely there. You're very fortunate to have such protection." "Why are you telling me this?" "I don't know. Perhaps I wanted to meet you again. Now I must go. Thank you for seeing me."
Elvira turns to go.
"Mrs. Ramos, is there something I can do for you?"
But the other woman doesn't turn. She has her bags with her at the hotel desk. She signals a sleepy night clerk to bring them to a cab outside, and she disappears into the night.
Yeah. Well, what happens to her?
Again, we'll have to wait and see. More important developments are underway. Now we're on the countdown to the opening of the global mind. We get reports of breakthroughs and positive projects all over the world. Just 1 week before the opening, Mark and Esther put on another global telecast. And from the Star of Jerusalem, as a prelude to the main event, all of the Globecoms report in telling stories, showing scenes of accomplishment.
The countries are mentioned by name only in passing. What's important is the activity in the streets and the countryside, where people of all ages, countless cultures, innumerable occupations are shown working together, unconscious of borders or differences, working together on projects to make life better, agricultural, industrial, artistic, scientific, and educational projects. Everywhere the cameras go, they pick up the familiar blue and white uniforms of the visioneers, moving among the people. They tell stories of pride and accomplishment, cooperation and enterprise, scarred landscape restored, bankrupt factories brought into production, farming revitalized, bureaucracies energized, communities working together. Nowhere are there scenes of violence or bloodshed. No weapons, no military vehicles, no soldiers in uniform. Only the visioneers in blue and white, enlivening debate, challenging assumptions, pushing people to think, to dream, to believe in themselves, and to dare to act to make a positive difference. Across all degrees of latitude and longitude, through every climatic zone, the trisets of the visioneering world are swept together, holding the balance, pushing the communications, engaging the spirit. The remaining globecoms show their work. The Machu Picchu Diamond, the Australian Rock, the Kilimanjaro Watchtower, and all of their people, George Cardinal, Carmen Santander, Irene Henshaw, Boris Gunther, Daniel Thomas, Sally Hurst, President Mutsando, General Soulière, and Carl Ibsen. In a glorious kaleidoscope of human energy, linking with the energy of the earth, flowing together in an unfathomable ocean of opportunity, achievements, and enterprise. As it sweeps to a finale, the Song of the Visioneers comes up, and marching across the screens, viewers everywhere in the world see their children, countless millions of them of every race and color, their voices raised, their eyes shining, singing. We are the ones going to the fore. Big ones, little ones, all of us are here. Small world, big world, reaching out to all. Up, up, and upmost, the mighty visioneers. As the last chords of the children's singing fades away, the image of the blue and white planet Earth comes up again. It holds for a moment, then slowly dissolves into a sea of liquid golden light. Music of a gentler rhythm rises slowly. Harmony of creation, the melodic tonal beauty of the Baroque, distilling into the evocative, mysterious strains of Eastern meditative chant. The light scatters. It breaks away, revealing the lush green of a garden setting. On a white bench, before a flowering hibiscus tree, a man wearing a saffron robe sits with eyes closed, gently rocking back and forth. Some of the viewers recognize him from the brief appearances at the memorial service for Louis Valdez and at Mark and Esther's wedding in Jerusalem. For most, however, he's a new actor on the stage of the Visioneers. He raises his head and looks out to the world through luminous brown eyes.
I am Baba Satchinanda, and I bid you welcome from my place of peace and serenity here in the ashram of Ventagiri in India. For many months I have followed the adventures of the Visioneers, and my heart leaps with joy as I watch with you this evening and see all that they have done. They are poised now to bring to the world a new beginning. I speak to you a few words so that you may know of where this change comes and why this is the time for it. You must know that these are days of great urgency. A turning point has come. The countdown is upon you, the people of the earth, to make massive shifts in your relationships to each other and to the planet. The earth is part of a perfect universe of love, forever in creation, flowing with an energy that is the source of all life. Your role as the highest form of all creation on the planet is to discover and embrace that universal energy and order all activity on the planet in the harmony of its perfect way. To the leaders of the world who are watching, hear these words and lead your people along the path of peace. To the leaders of business and government and communities, the same universal principles apply. Turn now to the energy of love and sharing, and away from the energy of conflict and bitter competition. The Earth cannot bear the force of mounting negative pressures. It will groan and creak and crumble under it, and you and your children will have lost forever your heritage to live in peace and tranquility on our wonderful planetary home. In the days to come, the Visioneers will show you the joy of following another path than the one you have been pursuing. You will experience the power of becoming one great river of human consciousness flowing together in the global mind. Then it will be up to you to choose. To choose the path of trust and love and sharing, or the path of anger, hostility, and conflict. Choose well, my dear ones, for the future of the planet and your children are in your hands. At the end of the telecast, Mark and Esther receive a violent reaction. In the words of Peter Hempel, there's been a blow-up. A rump group of world leaders has pressed the panic button and demanded an emergency meeting of the UN to review their commitment to the Global Mind Project. Mark has been half expecting this and goes them one better and has everyone brought into the Visioneering room. All of the mentors are there, and an extraordinary showdown now develops.
Mark has had some success in achieving order, but one by one the leaders are coming to their feet, attacking the idea of Visioneering as unworkable, complaining they were hoodwinked into supporting it, demanding everything be scaled back. Not all are antagonistic, however. On the other side of the debate, powerful and passionate arguments are made for what the Visioneers have accomplished and the hope that it has engendered in people otherwise destined for lives of misery. But still, the chorus of dissent swells loud. It's too much, too radical, unworkable, certain to bring chaos, unrealistic. The tide of negativity comes in, minds begin to close, those that struggle to withstand the flood begin to weaken, the carcinogen of doubt begins to work its poison, and faith in the miracle of Visioneering starts to fade from the majority of the room. Into this thickening gloom steps a mighty spirit.
Have you so soon forgotten?
Crashing his chair aside, Winston Churchill has leapt to his feet. He propels himself forward to stand squarely before this assembly of power. His nostrils flare, blood red, his dogged face thrust forward, and his eyes fix the audience with rivets of steel.
Here in this very room, you saw and felt and heard the dire consequences of continuing past thinking into future time. The masterful Mr. Dickens played them out for you. They burned in your minds again when you heard Mark Venture speak to you in the United Nations, and you enthusiastically endorsed the Congress of the Global Mind. Now, a few months later, when the inconvenience and threat of changing direction touches your administration, you begin to vacillate, change your minds, say what you thought perhaps will not be so. Well, let me tell you again, nothing is more certain than the slide of this planet into abject despair and desolation, far worse than anything we can believe or imagine, if men and women of new high mind do not emerge to steer it on another course. We shall play the scenes for you again, but this time place them in contrast with what you have just seen presented by the Visioneers after only a few months of their work. Then you may choose. You may choose to walk through the doorway to the future where current thinking takes us, or you may choose to pass through to where the Visioneers are proposing the world should go. You have been brought here to decide. This is a place of unremitting and binding choice, as fixed and sure as when you pass across the boundary between life and death. Mr. Dickens and Mr. Venture, with your assistance, the process will begin.
Then there follows a spectacle as extraordinary as any previously presented in this room. The space in front of the assembled leaders divides in two, and a beam of white laser light separates them. Charles Dickens moves to stand in the spotlight at the lower left, facing the audience, while Mark Venture takes a similar position lower right. The space behind Mark remains in darkness. On Charles Dickens' side, activity springs into light. The leaders are quick to recall the replay of the dreadful scenes they had seen before, when they were shown the future by the mastery of Dickens. Nothing is omitted. The horror of 100 million children exterminated by a wall of water in the blood-red canyon. Scenes of violent high-technology combat, reeking with a stench and carnage of mutilated bodies, ugly vistas of ruined landscapes, cities thick with smog, factories and machinery lying idle, hordes of unemployed people in long unending food lines, dying and stunted vegetation. The final set of scenes presents massive assemblies of violent people railing against their politicians, burning buildings, bombing churches, storming the legislatures. The faces of the political leaders jostled and pushed aside by these angry crowds are the faces of the leaders looking on in the audience. That side of the room darkens, and behind Mark a different panorama unfolds. It is a replay of what was seen on television a few days before when the watching world was taken on the journey through the trisets. The leaders in the visioneering room could again see countless millions of people in every nation, culture, color, and religious creed engaged in positive projects of cooperation. Among them, the blue and white uniforms of the visioneers stand out as working symbols of a worldwide creative force for good. The light now comes up on both sides of the laser barrier, and Churchill again steps forward to address the assembly.
You have seen. Now comes the moment to choose.
The final scenes, played out on both sides, come up again and are frozen in full view of the audience. Churchill continues.
Those of you who will choose to join your mirror images among the rioting masses may now get up and do so. Remember only this. If you choose that path, it will be your certain future. It is coming as it is shown. If you choose it, then it is yours. Those who want it, proceed now to claim your future.
No one moves. Churchill waits while time hangs heavy in the room. He then turns a belligerent, provocative gaze on those who had argued strongest before against the visioneers. His voice growls with the passion and anger of a lion enraged.
What? None of you wish to journey now where moments before your empty heads and wagging tongues would take you? No travelers now on the highway of bravado? No one who would any longer choose to plow ahead to collective and personal oblivion? Well then, may we conclude that if you are not for the one, then at least you will not obstinately oppose the other. Silence? I accept it as agreement. Perhaps my colleagues have something further they wish to add. I thank you for indulging the passion of one who has already used a lifetime in bitter struggle against the consequences of human wickedness. Like you, I would not willingly again choose such a path.
President Kennedy comes forward.
Friends, none of you can know the exact details of the future, but you all can search your minds for higher purpose to guide your choices. The visioneers would have us do that. You owe them the opportunity to show you their crowning piece.
Anne adds a word. For the sake of all the unborn children, choose well for life and for love.
Charles Dickens gestures to the scene behind him and exclaims,
no greater purpose can we hold than to safeguard the world from a future such as that.
Mark and Esther come forward. Esther speaks. It's a privilege to share the space with noble and powerful minds. I bid you Godspeed in all you do to guide the future of the world.
And Mark concludes, leaders of the world, go forward now to embrace the global mind. Your leadership and vision has greatly assisted us in reaching this point. Thank you for that and for your presence. Go in peace. When next we meet, may it be in triumph.